I was, actually.
Let's go quick.
We were threatening to call you, and we were all grumbling.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order Monday, April 27th. Good afternoon, committee. We've got a few bills here that the chair intends on moving today. Most of these we have heard, and I'm going to start out by moving a couple of them. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2199. Victoria, you want to give us a brief summary of House Bill 2199? We heard it, I believe, last week and adopted three amendments on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2199 authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to oversee financial holding companies and bank holding companies, eliminates the 30-day posting requirements for consumer finance license applications, removes requirement that DCBS set fees for banks and trusts, credit unions, and consumer finance in a single annual rulemaking process, repeals regulations governing savings associations which no longer apply to institutions operating in Oregon, authorizes DCBS to share information with federal agencies that regulate financial institutions, moves date on which DCBS issues calculated discount rate from the first business day of each calendar year to the second Friday in December. And the committee has adopted the -1, the -3, and the -4 amendments, and we have all of the fiscals and revenue statements on those amendments.
Thank you. And committee, I believe, if you recall, DCBS described these amendments to us last week, and I believe the Bankers Association was fine with these amendments. I don't see Mr. Martinez in the room at the moment, but I know Mr. Savage. Mr. Savage, could you come up just for a second?
Mr. Martinez just joined us.
Oh, do we need to resend something?
Yes.
Oh, and there's Mr. Martinez, too. But we adopted on 2199 last week the -1, the -3, and the -4 amendments. And I assume everybody was okay with those amendments.
Mr. Chair, Lou Savage, Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Yeah, Mr. Martinez is here, but yeah, we basically took some of the language from another bill and put it into this bill and worked on it in a way that would meet their needs.
Okay, great. And he seems to be nodding his approval from the back. So thank you for coming forward. So with that, Representative Riley, could I get a motion, but it has a subsequent to Ways and Means that has been rescinded, so we will be making the motion to reflect that.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2199 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2199 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed there's a January 30 letter here in our packet signed by you on this. Is that right?
I don't know. I don't remember a January 30 letter, but
I've got one too, Mr. Chair.
You may, in fact, be correct.
Yep. Just wondered if that, in fact, is your signature, because it's very suspicious on mine.
Well, let me see if I can find the letter so I can identify that for you.
All right, Representative, I think you're funny here. No one else does.
Actually, that is my signature.
If you say so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that your only question?
Sir.
So you're wanting to work late and on Friday, too, huh?
Oh, I'll be quiet now, sir.
Mum's the word here.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, can you give us a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callen?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2199, having received required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the subsequent to referral to Ways and Means has been rescinded. Representative Riley, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Representative Riley will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2199 and open a work session on House Bill 3145. Committee, on this particular bill, I believe we have already adopted the Dash 5 amendment. I've gotten documentation from the Speaker's office to refer this bill to rules, so our motion will reflect that.
This is 3145.
Yep. Sure.
About that one.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3145 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3145 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm somewhat confused. Why wouldn't it go to rules before it went to the floor?
It does.
It does. That's the protocol for stating that. You can take up that okay. with the chief clerk's
okay.
office.
I don't want to work Friday either. Okay.
That's the way they like to have it said.
Got it.
Evidently.
Okay. Mr. Chair? I'm sorry, just
Representative Cowan.
I need to understand as well. Does this mean that then we are sending it with our recommendation?
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
We had already previously adopted the amendments, Representative Cowan.
Yes, I know.
Okay. So with that, no other discussion. Cindy, could I have a roll call vote?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3145, having received the required votes, is passed to the Committee on Rules. With that, I'll close a work session on House Bill 3145. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2370. Victoria, will you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2370?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2370 requires insurers to base offers of settlement on average of two independent valuations in cases where vehicles are declared a total loss. However, we did adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which basically gutted and stuffed that, and Senator Walker gave us the summary of that in her appearance here.
Relating to motorcycle training and safety courses and getting a credit with that on the insurance policies. Is that what I recall?
Sure.
That was the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2370. Is that correct?
Yes, we adopted them on the 22nd.
We adopted those on the 22nd.
Sorry, what was the bill number?
2370.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2370 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2370 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a no on this. Who isn't for more safety on motorcycles? But as you really look into this bill, and I appreciate Senator Walker coming in, because she is a motorcycle rider, but it doesn't say what the discount should be. She testified that they already offer this. Now, when she said they, I assume, from what I got, insurance companies already offer it. So for me, in this climate, you know, if you don't have any money, when in doubt, regulate. I am absolutely against this. I think we're solving a problem that isn't even there, and it does not rise to the level of the kinds of things that we should be looking at. Consumer protection. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I think if I remember the testimony correct, she stated that some insurance companies offer this, not all, that offer motor vehicle insurance. So that's my recollection. Appreciate your input.
Thank you.
So we have a motion on the floor, and it's no other discussion. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2370, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody like to carry that? Representative Matthews.
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2370. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2438. Colleagues, this was Representative Maurer's bill. It's got quite a bit of conversation. I would like to move this. We've got the approval to move this to rules, but I'm going to move it without recommendation.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't catch that. Did you say we're moving it to rules?
I did. I'm going to refer House Bill 2438 to rules without recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 2438 to the floor with no recommendation or subsequent to rules.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With no recommendation and with a subsequent referral to rules. Discussion? Not seeing any. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Is it possible for me to request permission to change my vote at this point? I believe it is. You haven't gavelled it close.
You may.
I would like to change my vote to no.
Okay. This is without recommendation.
I understand.
Okay. Representative Wingard, we're currently moving House Bill 2438 to rules without recommendation. Would you like to vote on that bill? There are currently two no votes, one from Representative Gilliam, one from Representative Cowan.
Are we still voting at this point?
We are.
He hasn't closed it. It's two rules without representation.
Okay, I'll vote no.
So is that, does everybody vote?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We still have the House Bill 2438, having received the required votes, is referred to rules without recommendation. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2438. Open a work session on House Bill 2962. Victoria, can you give us a description of House Bill 2962 and the Dash 1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2962 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules requiring contractors to submit complete lists of contractors and subcontractors to obtain certificate of occupancy for new residential structures and zero lot line dwellings, requires Construction Contractors Board to include certificates of occupancy obligations in notice, and contractors to provide a list of subcontractors to property owners, makes violations subject to civil penalty not to exceed $5,000, and we adopted the Dash 1 amendments on April the 24th.
And the Dash 1 amendments, colleagues, completely change the content of this bill. This bill is about the an employee of a resident of a dwelling unit, and who happens to be living in the employer's premises with an employment contract, and it deals with removing them from the household, I assume, when their employment ends. I don't know if everybody remembers this one. I don't know that it was real controversial, but...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 2962 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2962 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any.
This is the gun stuff.
Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
This is the gun.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Creer?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. Representative Barton, would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was almost going to put it on the consent calendar, but probably.
That's a better idea, Mr. Chair.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Anyone can fumble on the 1 yard line. It's me.
That's a great idea, Mr.
Not
Chair.
Not anyone would fumble on the
line. So let's put it on the consent calendar. Sounds like a good idea. Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, we'll put 2962 on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, let's sort a few. And those votes, take advantage of those.
Yeah, really. I'll make the speaker happy.
A little humor in our lives.
So, where are we at now?
Maybe Gillian, I guess.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Talk about you being a yes man.
Don't everything else I've been
open that.
I close, did I close the work session on that?
I'm not sure.
I'll close the work session on 2962.
We need to get
this
on
2004. You just did. Okay. Excuse me for a minute, colleagues, while I catch up with myself. Like to open a pub. See who's here. It's great.
They'll come flocking in.
Yeah,
outside.
If they're not here,
they're the ones we got an email.
I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3004.
They said the same thing.
And colleagues. not sure if David Neville's prepared to talk about this bill or not. He doesn't appear to be, so his colleague is not here. That's going to make it a little tougher.
This is the one that eliminates me.
Representative Barton.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We're looking at the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments on this bill. And committee, we're looking at the Dash 5, Dash 6 amendments on this bill. This bill was before us on Friday. It dealt with trustees that are in a situation. Jane Cummins is in the audience. She brought this issue forward, and it dealt with the first trustee, or one of the trustees, being foreclosed upon, and then later on the second trustee being sued for the note and leaving a deficiency that the consumer was unable to handle, when in fact the first and the second were part of the original purchase price of the bill. And this bill was brought forward by Representative Clem, and there has been some court cases about this issue, and courts have lamented that Oregon's law, from the documentation I received, needed to be fixed in this regard, because it put consumers in a position of getting foreclosed upon, and in fact then being sued for a greater deficiency than the value of the home. So that's what I believe the Dash 5 amendment addressed. The Dash 6 amendment addressed the condition that was brought forward by Guerrilla Capital and Chris Schultz. I'm hoping I've got this right. Maybe I've got it backwards. Actually, I do have it backwards. I described the Dash 6 amendment first, and so the Dash 5 amendment actually deals with Guerrilla Capital, and their issue that they were having was the trust deed was not being returned to them within 10 days after the trustee's sale, and they were having great difficulty getting these trust deeds back so they could move forward with their investment on their property. And originally in the bill, we suggested a 100-day fine for each day past the 10 days that the deed was not delivered, with a maximum liability of $5,000. That's now been reduced to $50 a day in the Dash 6, and maximum liability of $2,500. So we've basically cut the penalty in half on that particular
Mr. Chair, do we have any staff measure summary that describes the amendments?
I do not believe we do, because we just got them, and I was hoping that somebody would be here to discuss them, but I don't know that there's anybody here that's versed on this particular amendment. So I may want to roll this over if the committee wishes to have somebody more eloquently describe the bill, since we really haven't had time to read them. So I just wanted to put that on the record. We do have the fives and the sixes and the paperwork necessary to pass the bill. And hopefully we can get someone here tomorrow to speak to us on this bill. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Things sort of mushed together at this point. But wasn't there some opposition to one of the amendments?
Mr. Carnes.
He had some questions about one of the amendments, but I can't remember which one, and I didn't write that down.
Yeah, it was the and that was what the Dash 6 amendment was in supposed to have fixed those issues, but I don't know that Mr. Carnes has seen these amendments yet, and so I'm not sure everybody's seen these amendments yet, so I'm going to hold this one over till the last meeting tomorrow. I know Chris Schultz is in the audience. I don't know if he wants to speak to the other amendment or not. I assume you're probably okay with the other amendment. It's not the penalty that was suggested, but some committee members felt that a penalty was a little steep. so we decided to reduce it. So with that, I think we'll just go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 3004. Committee will try to work that quickly tomorrow evening. With that, I'll open
No, that's the one we just got the dash two amendment from. We just got the amendment today.
Okay.
We have permission to make the rule of amendment.
Okay. Committee, I have one other bill that I wanted to refer to rules. I skipped over it. House Bill 3359. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3359. And at this point, I think I'd entertain a motion to move this to rules without recommendation.
Has it been amended?
It has not been amended.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3359 to the Committee on Rules without recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Fallon?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3359, having received required votes, is moved to the Committee on Rules. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3359. Oh. That, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3163. Victoria, can you give us a preview of House Bill 3163?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3163 requires facilitators of refund anticipation loans to be licensed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services and maintain a $25,000 surety bond or letter of credit. Requires licensees to file schedule of loan fees and annual percentage rates with DCBS and provide borrowers with sample loan costs and total fees. Provides for enforcement under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, effective on passage. And I believe you have dash one amendments in front of you.
Thank you. And when did we first hear this bill? It's been a while.
March 27th.
Seems like a while. So we have dash one amendments to this bill. And I'd like to, I don't know who's prepared to speak about the dash one amendment. I have Mr. Wagner from the Board of Tax Petitioners and Tax Practitioners, excuse me. And Lou Savage, did you want to speak on this bill at all? No? Sort of moved out of the DCBS realm. Thank you. If you want to come forward. Have you had a time to look at this amendment?
I did have some time to take a look at it.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Ron Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon State Board of Tax Practitioners. And I'll My testimony will be brief this morning. Chair Holfe and members of the committee said I have had an opportunity briefly to review the amendments and the dash one amendments provided. We have also provided a fiscal impact statement to you that's being passed out to you currently. We're a consumer protection agency. We're in favor of protections, of course, to consumers, which we feel that this bill continues to do. We're seeking to administer these changes with no additional staff, no additional funding. We believe that we can do it with our additional staff. We anticipate there would not be any large increase in our workload. The board will maintain some adequate data for the future if we do need to report back. Also, we'd like to just, for our own purposes, know what kind of effect this board may have. We currently do have provisions in statute for some protection to people regarding the refund anticipation loans. I believe that this does look like it strengthens some of the protections to the consumers. And so we, with that, we actually are neutral on the bill. I guess somewhat in favor of it, but we see no. We're certainly here to administer the bill as it passes, and would answer any questions you might have today.
Thank you. Can you summarize what the bill, what this amendment does to the bill?
What this amendment does is, with any one who offers the refund anticipation loans. Generally are, under this bill, are licensed tax practitioners. We have two levels of practitioners that we license. We have licensed tax consultants and licensed tax practitioners. If they offer, if the businesses offer refund anticipation loans, they would be required to provide to the board at the time of licensing information that they will be providing to the clients showing. Now, there's quite a list there that they will have to provide to us. They will also be required to be bonded before offering those refund anticipation loans. Section 4, I believe, lists the information that they must provide to the board. Did you want, Gerald, did you want more specific information than that?
No, I think I can see the list.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is it the proverbial gut and stuff?
Almost.
Yeah. I think so.
Yes, sir.
Deleting pages 2 through 13.
Correct. Correct.
But
so, if you would just sit tight there, I'm going to call up Angela Martin and Sybil Hebb next, and maybe they can go through and help describe the bill as well, maybe familiarize the committee a little bit more with what this bill is, because we haven't had this amendment
very long either. Angela Martin with Our Oregon for the record. This is not a gut and stuff. The reason it reads that way is because the amendments shifted oversight from DCBS, which is what the original bill called for, to the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. So all those sections needed to be removed and placed into the correct section of the statutes. The policy has not shifted from the dash ones from the original bill. The policy is pretty straightforward. Currently, RAL lenders, Rapid Refund Anticipation Loan lenders, are licensed under the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. This bill would add to that regulation by expanding the disclosures that are required so that consumers have a greater chance of understanding the loan that they would be receiving. This bill makes a policy shift in that it caps the cost of these loans, and that's what you'll read in the Dash 1 amendments as well. Facilitators would be allowed to charge up to 36% APR, and then the lenders would be allowed to charge the amount. We're not capping the fee on the banks and the loans that they charge. The example I pass out, I think, best explains where this policy comes from. As I'm sure you all know, in Oregon law, loans are capped. Short-term consumer loans are capped at 36%. We allow for additional fees for payday loans. The sheet that I just passed out to you is actually a fee schedule I picked up from a refund anticipation loan shop right around the corner from me. Also happens to be a payday loan shop. These folks are licensed under the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners and offer refund anticipation loans, as you can see with my examples here, that to the tune of $112 for a $500 advance, or for a $2,000 advance, $129. The same shop under Oregon law offers short-term loans, and they are allowed to charge no more than $45 for a $500 loan under Oregon law. But if they're making the loan against a tax refund, they're allowed to charge more than twice as much. So this bill, we're bringing in the line and say that a policy is we charge folks 36% interest on short-term loans, one of the most secured loans out there against your taxes. The testimony that you have on file from the March 27th hearing that I submitted then all remains because, again, this Dash 1's amendments did not change the policy, changed the oversight of that. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Sybil, would you like to add anything to this?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Head with the Oregon Law Center. I would just like to add my support for the concept of the protection that's proposed by the Dash 1 amendments. We do think that this is a legitimate business service to offer, but we think that the fees ought to be brought into comparable restrictions that apply to other short-term loans, and appreciate the committee's attention to the issue.
Thank you. I'm going to start out with a question. I know currently, or maybe not, there's a lot of tax preparation models out there that use federal chartered banks for their loans, and we can't regulate what they charge. And so this bill doesn't do that, I would assume.
Chair Holmey, members of the committee, this bill proposes a cap on what a facilitator may charge. That is not a depository institution. To facilitate a tax refund loan, to make a tax refund loan in Oregon, you have to be licensed as a tax practitioner. Banks do not have to be licensed tax practitioners. CPAs do not have to be licensed tax practitioners, so this does not impact the type of work that they may do. So the answer to your question is no, we're not, through this policy, not capping what a federally chartered bank may charge.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you. Follow up on that question. So the way I understand the facilitator does not actually make a loan. They facilitate a loan from a lending institution. So the fee that we're allowing the facilitator is on top of the cost of the loan. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, correct. This bill caps the fees that the facilitator would add on to the cost of the loan. The best way to look at that is the section here we see that there are bank fees and facilitator fees. We are proposing capping the cost of those facilitator fees.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question's for Mr. Wagner.
Yes.
You mentioned, I think you said at the beginning, that you are an organization that's either supportive of or part of your mission is consumer protection. Why do you think the switch in this bill from one agency, from DCBS to you?
Well, Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, I believe the reason is that as a businessman, they already go to the Secretary of State's office to register a business name. They come to us, they have to register as an individual licensee. They also register with us their business. This would, if it was with DCBS, it would require a third agency to work with for licensing. And so it was our proposal that they're already dealing with us. Let's just add it to the licensing requirements that they already do with us.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
What, just in a nutshell, what authority do you have either by rule or statute now in this regard, in confining or controlling fees? What are your tools now?
Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, currently we do have statute under 673 of the Board of Tax Practitioners. There is no limitation under statute on the fees.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when this thing was first presented to me, I was, and I don't mean to demean what we're trying to do here, but it seemed to me like it's almost like priority shipping. You would know if you're going to anticipate your loan and you need it quickly, that it would cost you a little more to get it. But I'm just trying to figure out, can you just take me through how we get to 824% in the very first, if you wouldn't mind, Angela?
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, I always get a little nervous not to do math for a crowd, but I'm happy to walk you through this. APR, as you know, is simply a calculation that allows you to compare two different loans of two different durations. So it's a basic standard calculation. This example starts off with a $500 loan. I'm anticipating a $500 tax refund. I'm asking for a $500 loan. If we run through the fees that are charged, the filing fee, the state electronic fee, the check at the store fee, the check to the customer fees, all of those added up equal $112.95. If you take the number of fees, divide it by the loan amount, $500, divide it by the number of days in the loan, which is 10 days, multiply that by 365, multiply it by 100 so that you get the decimal point in the correct position, you arrive at 824%. It's the same calculation that was done for the example on the other side.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
It's my understanding that these, when filed, and these are people that are licensed tax practitioners or, you know, when these are filed, that refund goes to them. They give the loan to the individual petitioner. But the refund goes towards paying that loan. Is that correct?
Sure.
So as an example, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be not so clear. If let's say, for example, you're anticipating $500, but it ends up only being $430. That check for $430 would be directed to the folks that were the tax practitioner. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, that's often how it works, that what's called a dummy account is set up. So I sign over authority for my tax refund to be sent to whoever facilitates, the lender. Yeah, the lender, the facilitator passes me along to the lender. They set up an account. So my refund is actually directed to them. They remove the proceeds of the loan. So if I borrowed $500, I actually get $600 back. They would remove the $500, send me the $600. Or in your example, take the $470 and then call me up and say, you still owe me $30.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Representative Winger, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Originally, when we had this discussion about the bill, I had some questions about whether or not we could create the same kind of fiduciary responsibility that CPAs and others have for their clients. So we had some, because originally this discussion was around unconscionable fees, and I thought, well, why is the person who's doing this treated differently than a CPA or someone else who is supposed to be looking out for the best interest of the taxpayer that they're filing? Am I incorrect that expectation is placed on CPAs right now? That they would make the decision that's in the best interest of the tax filer?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingert, I'll answer this and then look to others as well. Under current law, CPAs are not required to be licensed tax practitioners. So I can't speak to your question. What I can speak to is how we are proposing to expand current regulation of tax practitioners and their ability to make refund anticipation loans.
That's correct.
Not seeing any other questions for this panel at this time. Thank you very much. Representative Rogers, do you have a question?
No, thank you.
I appreciate you coming forward and laying out this amendment for us. Next up, I have Matt Marquis. Good afternoon, Mr. Marquis, and I don't know if you've really had a lot of time to look at this amendment yet, but identify yourself for the record anyway.
Mr. Chair, Matt Marquis representing H&R Block today, and I actually got the amendments about 15 to 20 minutes before the hearing started today and quickly got them to our client, who is frantically going through them probably as we speak. But so I'll keep my comments somewhat brief because we just haven't had a chance to look at the amendments. But I do want to remind everybody here today that 4 years ago this body passed a refund anticipation loan bill that was crafted by Senator Perzanski at the time, dealing with disclosure, because that's pretty much all you can do in this area is require disclosure, because the majority of these loans are made through federally chartered banks and credit unions. That bill has actually been used as a model in several states here on the West Coast as far as putting disclosures into statute. Since then, there have been, to my understanding, virtually no complaints, and so I'm not really sure what problem we're addressing here today. And you heard some, you heard about lots of fees and different things from the proponents in their testimony, but I can tell you H&R Block on a $3,000 refund anticipation loan, their fee is $62, which is 2%. As calculated into an APR, that is about 36%. And as far as the amendments go themselves, just looking through them very briefly, as you look at the section in how you calculate APR, it's my understanding that this calculation is different than the Federal Truth in Lending Act. So as we're trying to, while you're trying to make this more friendly for the consumer so that they can compare things easily, I would just tell you this may make it more confusing as they're given two separate disclosures, one stating one APR and another stating another. Also, as far as putting an APR on a facilitator, it's also my understanding that in New Jersey and Connecticut, the courts have ruled that when a facilitator acts as an agent of the bank, which in H&R's Block's case, they're all contractually agents of the federally chartered bank, HSBC in this case, that you cannot put a 36% interest rate cap on those individuals. Also, as far as addressing a problem, there are two key people that are two key groups that make these types of loans, CPAs and also tax preparing software. This bill doesn't address either one of those two entities, and so I would suggest that if we're addressing a problem, which I don't believe is actually there, that we address it for everybody equally and not just one group. Again, I don't really know what the problem is we're addressing. We do have a lot of disclosures in place. Everybody right now, when getting a refund anticipation loan, is handed a disclosure separate than the Truth in Lending application or Truth in Lending document and from the application itself, showing exactly what their APR is and the differences between times of which they would get their tax refund if they weren't getting the loan. I think there are huge potential for unintended consequences here. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions. But again, I just started to look over the amendments and don't know what all is in there.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because actually I haven't had time to go through the amendments either at great length. So I appreciate you coming forward. Just a quick question that you did say that when a H&R Block agent is facilitating one of these refund anticipation loans, they are an agent of the federally chartered bank. Is that what I thought I heard you saying?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. They're through contract with the federally chartered bank, they are an agent of the bank.
Of the bank, and so they would not be able to be regulated in according to that, I guess, is what I'm hearing from you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not an attorney, but that is my understanding of the court cases out of New Jersey and Connecticut.
Thank you. Do you have any, I'm sure we could probably find it, but do you have access to those cases?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have them available today, but I could try to get them for you, yes.
Thank you. Any other, Representative Riley, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you'll know this or not, Mr. Marquis, but are all the tax preparers under the same kind of contracts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't want to speak on behalf of other companies. I'm not 100% sure. I know that 99.9% of these loans are made through federally chartered banks. At least that's what I'm told from our client. And so I would guess it's a very similar situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No other questions? Thank you. Oh, I have signed up right now, committee. I'm going to carry this bill over and give the committee and others time to take a closer look at these amendments and maybe have a couple of discussions about it. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3163. And I thought I was going to reopen another work session, but maybe I'm not.
The one with Mr. Carnes?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just showed up and then left.
So, what else is left on our agenda? I'd like to reopen a work session on House Bill 3004 and have Mr. Carnes come up for a moment. Good afternoon, Mr. Carnes. We just got some amendments, the dash 5 and 6 amendments to House Bill 3004. I made a meager attempt at explaining those amendments to the committee. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see these amendments yet.
I have, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes, for the record, and we're certainly made a great deal of progress since the last time, since last Friday. Just as a quick background explanation, I've given two documents. One is the trustee's notice of sale. The other one says figure A at the top and page 14 at the bottom. The trustee's notice of sale, the reason I give you that is because this trustee's notice of sale indicates who it is that holds the mortgage that's being foreclosed. And as you can see here, this mortgage is being held by the New York Bank of Mellon, formerly known as the Bank of New York, as successor in interest to J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., as trustee for the Securitized Asset Mortgage Investments 2, Inc., Bear Stearns, Alt A, Trust 2005-7, Mortgage Pass-Through Certificates, Series 2005-7, by assignment. They're the ones who hold this mortgage. And so if we are going to draft a statute that says only loans that are held by similar parties would not be able to collect a deficiency in the case of a 80-20 where the purchase price is split into two mortgages. If the bill were to say that only those that are held by the same entity, I don't know how we would ever have that case where it just so happens that the same mortgage is held by the same exact trust and the same investors. Figure A is the this I took from a law journal that shows how home loans are securitized and packaged on Wall Street. As you can see, it's a very complicated process and involves a lot of parties. As you may hear from the news, there's all kinds of people who have their fingers in this pie, from Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and other people like that. This is how loans go from me meeting with a broker to them being sold off in Wall Street. And so, just as a matter of background, this is what we're dealing with today. And so as I read House Bill 3004, the dash 6 amendments, it appears that what we're still trying to do is say that there has to be an affiliation between the people who hold the loans for there not to be a deficiency when the loan is split into two loans at the inception. And I don't know that that's really any protection at all, given how these loans are packaged and sold off. Usually the 80% loan will be a lower risk loan because they're in first position and there's lower interest payments and the like. And the second one is a higher risk loan and therefore wouldn't end up in the same trust. So I hate to bore you with securities law, but I think that's the issue that we have here when we look at House Bill 3004, that it's very rare that this would ever happen, that the same loan ends up with the same holders. To the extent that
the bill now, what it does is basically paragraph 2 on page 2 of the Dash 6 amendments eliminates for a residential trust deed an action for a deficiency by the grantor except for those in paragraph 4. And so in paragraph 4, those who are brought back into the fold as those who are allowed to bring a deficiency, our paragraph 4A deals with other security instruments, or a security instrument that deals with more than one property. Section B is dealing with guarantors for deficiencies on judicial foreclosures, which is very rare. Paragraph C is the
Mr.
part.
Mr. Chair, could you help me with where we are? I am completely lost. But could you refer to the page?
I'm sorry, I'm on page 3 of the Dash 6 amendments.
All right.
You look at the dash. While we're stopped, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Thank you.
Absolutely, Representative Kelly.
Thank you. I think I understand where you're going with this, Mr. Kimes, and I just want to make sure that I want to clarify. So I go to my local bank, Key Bank, and I get a loan, an 80% loan. That's the first loan, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then I can't afford the rest of the down payment, so maybe I get 15%, say. I can maybe pay 5%, and I get 15%, a second loan at Key Bank, right?
Yes.
Okay. So then my first loan, the 80% loan, that's going to go through this maze that you've given us, correct? That will go end up somewhere in a bunch of other loans, right? It's going to be consolidated. That because that's the first, what's your first position. That's going to be the safest loan. So somebody has bought that.
Correct.
In the ether somewhere. But that other loan, the 15% loan, that might still be at Key Bank, or maybe it's somewhere else. Is that correct? Am I correct in assuming that?
Representative Riley, Representative Tomei, that's generally not correct. There are very few banks who hold on to their own loans anymore.
Okay,
regardless
so
of the risk.
Where does that 15% does not go where my 80% loan went?
It goes on the third line of this.
If you look at the very top there, they rate these instruments as AAA. So if you pay your bills on time and this is a low-risk first mortgage loan, it would be rated AAA, and that would go to one pool. If it's BBB or unrated, meaning that
but
no
it's gone rated. Somewhere else.
It's gone somewhere
else. The 80%
else.
Has gone over here, and the 15% has gone somewhere else. Is that correct?
That is generally true in almost all cases.
Okay, so when we're trying to remedy this situation that we've heard about for some time, what I'm hearing from you is it's difficult to do that because whoever owns that 15% loan is different from who owns the 80% loan. So if you're trying to say if I pay off that 80%, then that pays off what I owe on this house. And from what I'm hearing from you, that doesn't take care of whoever owns that 15% loan. Is that correct?
Representative Riley, Representative Tomei, I don't know that payoff, but if the 80% forecloses, the idea behind 3004 was originally that when the 80% forecloses, the 15% should also be eliminated, their ability to gain the deficiency against you. What I'm telling you is that this is very hard to do definitionally because of this maze, as you described it aptly, that is, you know, figure A. And so how we come up with the words to describe this becomes very difficult.
Got it.
And how to explain it to a judge, because until you get like a trustee's notice of sale, 99.99% of the people have no idea who's holding this
right.
loan, what
Got
happened
it.
With it.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so back to page 3 of the Dash 6 amendments, subparagraph C.
Give us the line.
Starting with line 12, an action for a deficiency that remains after a trustee's sale or judicial foreclosure of a residential trustee, if that person brings the action, or an affiliate of that person, of the person that brings an action, does not foreclose on the trust deed, judicially or non-judicially. That, to me, I think, is the attempt to describe the problem that we have here, whereas by describing it as an affiliation is And affiliate is defined at the bottom of the page there, you know, person under common control. The problem that we have is that at the time of the foreclosure, these certainly aren't held by affiliates of each other. These are held generally by our retirement accounts. I mean, to the extent, you know, I may have interest in half of the mortgages in Oregon and not know it because the person I give my retirement money to is buying them. I don't know. And so this is an effort to close this loophole, but I still think that we're a little short of doing that unless we go back to the very beginning. At the bottom of this exhibit or figure A, there's the homeowner dealing with the originator. And I think that's the definition, that's where we need to focus in our efforts, is describing the transaction between the homeowner and the originator instead of describing the proliferation of the note after that. And I think with some definitional effort, we can actually describe that if that's what the committee chooses to do. And by so doing, we would get to this problem that was described, that 3004 is attempted to remedy.
So if I can interrupt you. So what you're suggesting is that if the two loans are from the same originator, is that where you're going with this?
Representative Riley, I believe that's what was being discussed. If I were king of the world, I would do it differently than that. But as I understand what the discussion with the Bankers Association and the like, what the goal was to pin it down to something like that. And this is my best understanding of how to do that.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect that all of us behind this dais really can get behind the intent of this bill. I think there would be, I mean, especially with such a compelling life story that brought this to the fore. I am growing increasingly skeptical that we can do it in a reasonable way in the time allotted to us. And also the risks of unintended consequences with this bill are potentially extraordinary. And I'm really, much as I trust our colleagues in the other chamber, and I don't want this bill to die over here just because we can't figure out a complex problem in time. At the same time, I'm torn. I don't know that I can vote yes on a bill that is not ready to go and that potentially has catastrophic consequences. And I just don't know what we can do or what I can do.
Thank you. Did you have more that you wanted to talk about, or did we?
Well, generally, Representative Riley, I think the last issue that I think this basically takes us back to where we are for all practical purposes. Take us to where we are today with one exception. Line 17 on page 3 says that you cannot bring an action on deficiency if you receive proceeds from the trustee's sale. This is a departure from current Oregon law. This is gives more protection to the borrower. So to the extent that Mortgage 1 forecloses and pays Mortgage 2 some money, that would preclude any deficiency if they accept the money instead of rejecting it. This is an additional consumer protection that I think is a good thing, but this is a departure from Oregon law and isn't something that was in the prior bills. Just in the interest of candor, I wanted to point that out. Other than that, I think I've done my best in the short amount of time I could to describe where this bill is and what I think the fix would be. And I think that describing it with the origination of the loan as opposed to who holds the loan would be the way to fix this problem. And I'm confident that it would fix the problem.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm close to what Representative Barton is saying. I'm completely supportive of the concept, but I'm completely confused by the process. I heard you say with a little more definitional work, we maybe could get there, and I'm interested in what you think that would take, considering we have about 24 hours to complete this work. And the second part of that question is, when you're talking about focusing on the homeowner and the originator, that would then go back to, in my world, the bank where the loan originated. And I'm wondering where the bankers are on that concept, because generally I think once the loan is sold, it's out of their purview.
Yes, Vice Chair Riley and Representative Cowan. I believe, to answer the first part of the question, there's the original intent of the bill, as I understood it, was that when it's the purchase price of the loan, that what we're trying to do is say the entire purchase price of the loan is foreclosed, not if it's split into one loan or two, whereas if you take out a home equity line of credit subsequently, that that's not foreclosed if the first does foreclose. And so I believe that definitionally there are some key legal terms that could be used, such as purchase money, security interest, and the like, that if we were to use those in here, it could be done in short order if the process permits time to do that. As to where the bankers are, I don't have an idea. I haven't been involved in any discussions with them.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm just wondering if the concern that's running through my mind is valid or not, I guess.
Yes. And before I take the next question, I want to ask the committee to have nobody else leave because then I'd have to stop. Representative,
I'll give you another
Vice
shot.
Vice Chair, go ahead.
Widener.
Thank you.
Just looking at this and what we have, I'm concerned about collateral damage as well. But it almost seems that maybe we should put a work group together, get all the parties in play. I don't know if you'd be open to that and actually coming back to the body with a bill that would accomplish everything we need to without damaging anything in the process and know that we have everything squared away. Next session.
Time would not
permit. Well, Vice Chair Widener, if that's the way the committee chooses to go, I would certainly be willing to put my effort into drafting such a solution if that's what the committee chose to do.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to recognize once again that Mr. Carnes is here kind of on his own and offering a great deal of his service to the state of Oregon, to the folks that are trying to find resolve. And I think it sounds to me like we're all in favor of trying to address the problem, but what we don't want to do is head down a path that we think we've addressed and we've created more problems for our citizens that want to get the 80-20 that can only qualify over that and also causing further impact to the banking industry and whatnot. So appreciate your effort and your willingness to step forward. I think that's a pretty reasonable solution. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to call back Ms. Hebb. If you would please come back to the... had something else you wanted to tell us.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I appreciate your giving me an opportunity to say a few words. I very much appreciate the efforts of Mr. Carnes and the goal behind this bill and would be willing to work at the committee's direction either here in the next 24 hours or if there was a possibility of a referral to the Rules Committee. I defer to the committee's instructions, but we do think it's a really important issue and that it would be good protection for folks. We'd be willing to work with the banks and all the interested parties. I did just want to briefly, just for the purposes of the record, make it clear that on page 2, lines 10 through 18, I have a concern about whether the language is drafted in such a way that would be inconsistent with a bill that is coming from the Senate in terms of rights that survive foreclosure. And so I just wanted to flag that for the record, and not a fatal issue, but certainly something that we can work on should the bill continue to move forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Kagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sybil, this is a little off the subject, and yet I want to ask you this. You all do a lot of work on behalf of deserving folks, and I'm impressed with the testimony of what the Oregon Law Center has done. But in the previous bill and this bill, my question is, in addition to your interest as an advocate down here, what are you guys doing to inform, support, etc., in an informal basis, low-income folks who may be preyed upon or may just be in a bad situation? And the last part of it is just that I so often get the feeling that we are regulating after the fact. But what I want to do is help folks. And I just thought I'd give you a chance to say something about that.
Thanks, Chair Riley, Representative Gilliam, and members of the committee. We do an awful lot. As you probably know, unfortunately, our services are, there's much greater demand for our services than we can satisfy. And because of lack of resources, we are forced to turn away 2 out of every 3 eligible folks we'd otherwise like to help. And so we do spend a percentage of our time, a significant percentage, trying to provide resources and education and doing outreach to people so that they can hopefully avoid problems. And so we have a website, which is at www.oregonlawhelp.org, and there are materials that are designed to be written at a grade level that is appropriate for our client base, and that are designed to be user-friendly for folks who may not be familiar with the legal system on a variety of different topics. Consumer law is one of the topics that we have a lot of information on. We also do education and outreach to community groups and to client forums in our communities, and I could go on, but that is very much a priority of our office because we just simply can't help everybody who once they get into trouble. So we do try to do education both to consumer bases as well as to service providers and to industry. For example, in the landlord-tenant realm, we provide outreach and education to landlords as well as to tenants, and that's the best way to try to reach a large group of people. But without the foundation of the protection in the law, our efforts would be merely just discussions. And so we do need to have that protection available for individuals who are harmed, and we do our best then to inform all parties about what the law is and how best to protect themselves. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? Ms. Cummins, did you want to say anything again? You don't have to.
I need to apologize to Jane because it's sort of my suggestion. I would just be interested in hearing your perceptions after all of this that we've heard. So,
for the record, my name is Jane Cummins, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I wasn't prepared to speak about the amendments because I have just received them myself a little while ago and quite frankly was a bit confused with trying to compare all the different issues. Originally, Oregon wrote its Trust Deed Act really as a pro-lender piece in that, in comparison with a mortgage, it made the foreclosed property more marketable and in that the borrower could not redeem. And it could be done in a short period of time, saving cost. And at the same time that language was written, the section 867702 was put in as a protection for consumers. And everyone, because I've been told by now by several lawyers, that it just most people assume that language protects consumers. If they are foreclosed, that if you have several trust deeds and notes in the original purchase, that there is one action to foreclose, one action that takes the property and, against you, instead of breaking it up piecemeal, taking the property and then having more actions against you, which is what is happening. And it happened because I would say of a case of a shrewd creditor, seeing that the market has changed. I think that we all realize that there have been abuses in the real estate market, and I think this falls into that category big time, where not only do you have this situation, but you have these companies, and in this case, a big company that's had notoriety nationwide, telling people, families, some of whom had good jobs, oh, you can get into a bigger house. We just need to tweak this a little bit and get you two mortgages. Now, I know that there are a lot of people, who need the 80-20, and that's fine, but what they do not understand is what happens if you have a downturn in the economy. Look what's happened to Oregon. People have lost their jobs. In many cases, especially in the Eugene area, both people have lost jobs, or one, and they've lost their houses, and they're caught in this where they've been foreclosed on. They don't have the security, that is, they don't have the property, they can't redeem it, and yet the people can keep coming after them for more money. And you can write these things in a way where you figure that if there is a default, boy, I can take the property, sell it, and then I can go after a big judgment. Somehow that is not protecting the consumers and is not the intent that the legislature had when they passed it in the 50s. And I think that Judge Warren in the appeals case who dissented, he was the presiding judge, he dissented, saying the construction that the majority held was absurd and unreasonable and undid the constraints that were written into the law. And the federal court in the early 2000s recognized the loophole and said it's one that a shrewd creditor will find, and they have. And they found it big time in Oregon. It may be hard to figure this out because of the changes in the real estate market. And I would say that, you know, some of the changes and this breaking up is probably doing consumers a lot of harm in some ways, and this is one of them. But that doesn't mean that consumers shouldn't be protected, and I thought that this would be a good committee to come to, and I'm hopeful that something can be done. But I certainly am aware that you can sometimes have unintended consequences, and I would not like the situation to be made worse. I don't understand the sixes to understand that that would not be the case, that there would not be unintended consequences, but I would have to ask some lawyers on that, and so I can't really speak to that. Thank you for the opportunity to comment again.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? I appreciate you coming forward and following this issue. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3004? Not seeing anybody at this point. Committee, there are two different amendments on this bill, and I am going to carry this bill over till tomorrow. And so you can consider whether you like or dislike one or the other or both, and we'll take it up tomorrow. Victoria, what is so with that, I don't think we have anything left on our agenda that we're going to deal with today. So with that, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2932, House Bill 3163, House Bill 3004, and House Bill 2784.
Could you repeat those, Mr. Chair?
And we'll carry over... Nope, that's it.
Could you repeat those?
2932, 3164, and 2784. Any other discussion? We're going to recess for just a minute.
save people from themselves.
Reopen the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3004.
Oops.
I'd like to suspend the rules to allow Representative Winger to vote on House Bill 2199. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Winger, how do you vote?
Say the number again,
2199. Everybody was pretty positive about it, if that helps.
Jeez.
You'd be the only no.
Yes.
Representative Winger votes yes.
Thank you.
And House Bill 2370. I'd like to suspend the rules again to allow Representative Winger to vote on House Bill 2370. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Winger, how do you vote on House Bill 2370?
Caught me off again.
As amended. That was the motorcycle.
Oh, the green people.
About
some insurance. Motorcycle classes.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one that's not necessary.
No. I remembered it.
Any discussion?
I remembered it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. With that, I'm going. We have carried over all our bills, and I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
We'll meet tomorrow night.